Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. This week I'm talking with Dr. Carol Stewart. Dr. Stewart has been working in the field of child and youth care for over 30 years. She has worked within residential and community-based child and youth care organizations across three provinces. As a formal educator, she has taught at both undergraduate and graduate levels and has recently accepted the position of Dean of Health and Human Services at Vancouver Island University. Dr. Stewart is the managing editor of Relational Child and Youth Care Practice, the author of numerous articles, and most recently two books, Foundations of Child and Youth Care, published in 2010, and Right Here, Right Now, Exploring Life Space Interventions for Children and Youth. I spoke with Carol over the telephone from her office on Vancouver Island about her new publication, Right Here, Right Now. Hello, Carol, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Wolfgang. I am pleased to be here.
Excellent. So you've just finished co-authoring Right Here, Right Now. It's a very informative book. It's provocative. It's engaging. And I want to thank you for writing it. I think it will really help many, many people in the field. Let's start by having you tell us what life space is and then what life space interventions are.
Life space is an interesting concept, and one that has been part of child and youth care language for a long time, and originally came out of a German author and theorist who moved from Germany to the United States and was actually interested in he was more of a sociologist than a psychologist. And so he had a very kind of loose definition of the concept, which would be akin to our concept of the ecological perspective. So really what he was saying was, when you look at the individual, you have to account for the environmental space that surrounds them. Right? That was kind of the basis of his conceptualization of life space. And I know I'm not answering your question directly, but some of this is important thinking about the concept of life space and about the way we've defined life space in the book. Because the psychologists who were working in residential care at the time, and so this is late 40s, early 50s, residential care was big. There were big institutions that were developing and so on, and they were looking for ways to help frontline practitioners think about the work that they were doing with children and how they could use environment and the importance of all of the things that happened outside of therapy, which was, you know, an hour a week with the psychologist, right, or the psychiatrist.
Right, the other 23 hours, as we say.
That's right. So they kind of pulled this conceptualization of life space into the work and the writing that they were doing in residential care, and just sort of put it out there. And it really came to mean the physical environment and the use of the physical environment that surrounds the children in residential care, and how we could use that as practitioners to create interventions for young people that were in care. And a little later on in the early 70s, it was picked up in a way that is probably familiar to many people now who are in practice, particularly people who are working in the school system, as life-based crisis intervention, which then became a model or a way of working with young people in particular when they were in crisis, that helped them to recognize how they were triggered by things in the environment, then help people work through kind of a problem-solving process and a debriefing process with them, and then look at how could they do it differently next time so there wasn't a crisis. Right? So it's the notion of the use of daily events or events that happen in the life space to therapeutic advantage. But again, still very sort of timed in the moment and in the physical environment. So I've wanted for a long time to rethink those notions of life space, to bring those concepts back to life, if you want, and think about them in a different or a new way, given the multiple contexts that we now work in child and youth care, and also given the changes in the way society is nowadays, right? So you have young people being very, very technically savvy and just putting their lives out there on the internet. And that's a component, to me, that was a component of their life space, but one that was missing in the initial conceptualization of life space. Although when you go back to the original theorist, it's there. It's just, of course, they didn't have technology then, right?
Right. There was no Facebook for them to post upon.
That's right. No Facebook for kids to post. So we started thinking about, well, how can we rethink what it means, what life space means to kids that we're working with today. So we came up with the four dimensions, the physical dimension, which is already fairly present and most people have a fairly good grasp of. The mental dimension, which is your interpretation of the people and the environment, the physical environment that surrounds you. So it's really about your perceptions of what you see. And of course, we know in terms of perception that not everybody looks at the half glass of water in the same way. For some people, it's half empty, and for some people, it's half full, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the mental dimension of your life space. You look at things and you place an interpretation upon those physical things that surround you. And then, of course, child and youth care is about relationships, certainly for me and for many people that are working within it. And life space has a relational dimension as well. So we don't just exist in this little bubble in our physical environment, and our thoughts are not just a part of our own bubble. They are influenced by other people. They're set in relational contexts. We have a different way of thinking perhaps when we're present with our parents than we do when we're present with our friends. And so that there's a relational component to life space as well, both existing relationships and developing relationships. And so we have to account for that when we want to think about life space and work with life space. And then the fourth dimension that we added was the virtual dimension, and I've already alluded to the notion of virtual in the sense of technology and Facebook and the ability to interact through technology, through texting and all of those kinds of things. But we also added to the concept of the virtual dimension the idea of fantasy and imagination. Because we, beyond the way we perceive things in our physical environment, which is the mental dimension, we, most kids and adults as well, have a very active imaginary life that they participate in that is relatively internal unless you really add that to your conceptualization of where they live. And that for some of them, they live in that imagination a good portion of their time. And so if we're going to do life space intervention, then we better ask about that. We better think about that and account for that in our interventions and accept it, because it's a part of the way young people exist within their life space. So it became a much bigger concept with those four dimensions as a way of thinking about and organizing, helping other people to think about the various components or dimensions of the life space. And then the other piece that we added to that was the notion of learning, and that really the life space is about learning about life, and that your process of moving through your life space and of experiencing your life space is about learning, and that therefore that's what we're wanting to do in our interventions, is to enhance the learning, to change the learning, to influence the learning that young people have in those various dimensions of their life space. And you can account for all of the dimensions in that process, or you can focus more on one. It's really, as a practitioner, making some decisions about where you're going to go with it and how you're going to think about those dimensions in your intervention.
The four dimensions I found were very, very helpful construct to understand the space and to see the different components. It was a great way to break it down. And then certainly the learning, and I want to talk about the learning. You claim that the learning is the core activity of therapeutic change. And you actually write that change is assessed by the extent that learning has taken place for the young person. And what I understand by that is the purpose of our work is to help the young person learn. Would you say that's correct?
Yes, with the caveat that the learning is different from teaching, right? Which, as an educator, is probably, it's obvious to you, because I know you do both practice and education, but I don't think, always obvious to particularly new practitioners, and sometimes experienced practitioners forget that, right? So the whole point of intervention is to enhance learning, but learning doesn't necessarily mean that the person has gotten or changed what you thought you were teaching them.
Right.
So the learning might be very different from your original intent as an intervener. It's important to understand what they learned as well as what you were trying to teach.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. There's the way the book is written is quite nice. As you follow these different characters, with each chapter you introduce a different character, and the final chapter, you give the chapter over to them as they each of those characters shares about their learning. And there's a powerful moment as I was reading it where one of the characters thanks all the people who have worked with her and even those that tried to put her down, tried to restrain her, and she thanks them for her learning. It was powerful for me because it really highlighted the idea of agency, and that the young people that we work with can take all their experiences and learn from all their experiences and grow from those experiences. The idea of agency is one that you put front and center, and you contrast agency with structure. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about how structure can negatively impact young people, and then how we can support agency with young people to navigate those structures.
You know, if we didn't have structure and various structures in the world, we would pretty much be living in chaos, right? So structure is important to what we do, and to our lives just in general, and to young people's lives. But structure can often get in the way of things that young people need to learn, and perhaps in the way of supporting them to grow and develop and be successful in either what we've defined or in what they may have defined, and those might be two different things. And you know, you think about the classic stereotype of the young person from sort of 12 or 13 up to about 25, and just constantly resisting against the structures that are in place. You know, and some of us continue to do that well into our adult years and perhaps even until we die. And, you know, there's a certain kind of personality piece that goes with that as well. But it's particularly added in the phase of development that adolescents and young adults go through. And sometimes rallying against those structures can be more harmful or more detrimental to the young person. So that then becomes kind of a focus for us in helping them to develop some skills, which is really what's happening in that period of their life anyway, helping them to develop some skills to know how to manage their structure, so to have agency or to have the power to be able to work with either within the structure, with the structure, or to work to change the structure in a productive manner, productive meaning it's not harmful to them. And so that's part of the learning that they need to do at that time in their lives, and is I think, particularly important for the young people that we work with who are in care, who are in child protection, or who are struggling through school, struggling with behaviors that are against the structures that we define as being appropriate in society, that famous child and youth care word. So part of our job is to help them figure that out and to learn some ways of being more effective in advocating for themselves and creating some change.
It's an interesting idea that our role is to help them navigate the structures rather than us trying to have them fit into the structures.
Right.
So much of what is taught when working with children and youth is that, you know, we need to do a behavioral intervention so that their behaviors fit into the structure of school, of education, et cetera, et cetera. Are there any risks to the young people as we help them develop agency?
Well, sure.
and how do we navigate those dangers?
I think that they aren't just risks to the young people; they're risks to us, right? So the ethics that we need to hold, the morals and the guiding principles that we work with around how to do that. You know, sometimes the agency that you develop against a structure can create a huge risk for you. So it's not just about, teach them how to do it and let them go nuts. It's about helping them to understand and us being very good at doing a risk assessment as they're developing that agency, you know. So timing is everything. Timing might not be right to exert your agency right now. And so it's helping them to struggle through that in small elements and in safe ways. So instead of taking on the entire system, let's just pick this little piece right now, which is pretty low risk, because if you go for the big picture, you may end up in a location that you don't want to be. And so it's helping them to understand what the risks are as they develop their agency, and then gradually helping them to develop those skills to do that assessment for themselves.
Do you find any resistance from other practitioners or larger structures to that concept?
We're just putting this stuff out.
So not yet.
You know, we've had generally, I think, quite positive feedback so far, but the book is just out.
Right.
So, I would anticipate that, yes, there's going to be resistance that there's going to be people who, practitioners who think they're doing that. And if you really push and uncover that, they'll be challenged because they're not, and they won't want to hear that they're not helping young people develop agency, but in fact they're making decisions for them.
It's hard for us, right? Because we all come into the field wanting to help. Certainly, absolutely. every student I've ever taught, that's why they want to come into the field.
Yeah.
And so some of the ideas that you're presenting really challenge how people understand help. You talked about how we all have our own mental dimension, and we all see things from our own perspective. And that brings me to the idea of the youth worker, because of course the youth worker, child and youth worker, child and youth care practitioner, has their own life space that they're navigating.
Right.
How do we use self effectively within life space? Because it seems to me that life space, more than many other intervention techniques, requires the use of self explicitly in work with the young person.
Yeah. Big question. We spend a lot of time, particularly in child and youth care education, helping people work with self, helping people identify self, bring self-awareness. You know, I think the notion of life space will give students and practitioners one more tool to or framework to think about self and to figure out where they are in each of those dimensions and what aspects of the dimensions are important to them, and also to think about, you know, where they fall on the structure agency line, right? So, or on the dimension between those two. So are they the ones that are most frequently saying, well, no, that's, you know, those are the rules, so this is the way we need to do it, or are they the ones that are saying, those are stupid rules, let's try this, and perhaps getting in trouble because of it. So, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us as practitioners, and particularly incumbent upon educators, to really help people to understand their own life space and all of the dimensions of that are coming into the work that they're doing. And life space is an evolution, right? So when I look at my life space right now and I think about how I might work with kids right now, it's very different from when I came into the field and when I came into practice, because there's so much more to it, and there's so many different facets and aspects of that. And so some of it is just giving younger practitioners a permission to make some mistakes, hopefully not critical ones, and also to talk with more experienced practitioners about their life space and begin to learn from them and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I think this book really, I mean, the way it's framed, there's opportunities at the end of each chapter for reflection and active engagement with the concepts, both for the individual reader as well in their own life space, as well as for the reader as a practitioner. And I found those quite nice opportunities to think about the application. I think that worked well. One of the things I really struggled with a lot in the book was boundaries. And I was so grateful when you had an entire chapter on boundaries for me to sink into and explore. You really challenge a lot of the things that are taught in this field about what is appropriate boundaries. You give examples of people texting and Facebooking and being in a virtual realm together. You give examples of, you know, people being called off hours and coming into work. You talk about that the in life space work, identifying the nature of accepted practice may be more difficult since the work is more personalized. how do we negotiate those boundaries in life space work?
I'm sure you asked an earlier question about whether we've been challenged on some of the ideas that are present.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that Chapter 6 and the way boundaries are conceptualized in there would probably be the most challenging thing and the most challenged area when people are reading, because, and I'm going to come back to the notion of structure here, is that I think that agencies and organizations who work with young people and families have created structures, right? So
mm-hmm.
the rules become, no, the kid is gone from the program, you don't have any contact. Texting is not allowed in school. Kids have to turn off their cell phone as they come in the door, right? Those are all structures that are put in place to create boundaries around the way kids interact and the way we interact with kids. And all done for valid reasons, because there are risks in the nature of those interactions. And so really what it comes down to is, can you as a practitioner take the individual responsibility and agency to create safe boundaries and do safe boundary management to identify your risks and to figure out, and boundaries aren't universal, they're different with everyone. And if you just think about, instead of thinking about boundaries as a professional concept, if you think about it as a personal concept and you think about it in your personal life, you have different boundaries with your family than you do with your friends, and you have some friends that have one boundary and you have other friends that have another boundary. And so all we're suggesting is that that same fluidity of boundaries concept applies to professional boundaries in the work that we do. And that does put a huge responsibility on the professional to be clear about their boundaries, to negotiate, to talk explicitly about boundaries in a way that doesn't necessarily name those, right?
Yeah, it was neat to see you frame those conversations, right? So rather than telling new youth workers you cannot, never acknowledge the person until they acknowledge you when you walk down the street, you're framing it as you need to have a conversation with the young person about how do you relate when you're in a public space. And I thought that was a really helpful way of framing it for all of the readers.
And you're not, you're not always going to get, there will always be times when you didn't think you had to have that conversation until you're faced with it. Walking down the street is a good example, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm working with a client that lives 100 miles away. Why would I have that conversation? I'm driving out there. I'll never see them in my hometown.
Right.
And then, oops, there they are. We also have to be comfortable with the client. We have to be comfortable addressing it in some other kind of manner. You can read body language. You can do eye contact and try to figure out the message from there, right? If the client initiates contact, well, then it's probably okay. you take a lead from them, right?
Yeah.
So there are many, many ways of having the conversation without actually talking about it, if necessary.
Nicely said.
The actual conversation is the best way to go.
And a great opportunity to bring all these things out and to discuss the different dimensions of the relationship as it crosses. As I was reading the book, I thought, wonderful, wonderful, great, yes, this sounds inspiring, this sounds right on, I like this idea, and I kept thinking, does it work? And I'm afraid to ask that question, because I'm worried that you will respond that that's about a control-oriented, solution-focused, evidence-based perspective, and that this is about
right.
something different. Does it work? Is it effective?
Okay. So I think I'll answer that from two perspectives. So one of the things, given the amount of time that I've been in education for child and youth care, and particularly in sort of university-level education where people are talking about theory and research and so on, kind of a constant refrain for me it has been about theory. We need a child and youth care theory, right? We're using psychology theories. We're using educational theories. We need a child and youth care theory. So for me, that's what we set out to do here, was to frame some theoretical concepts that were grounded in our child and youth care experience. Not grounded from the point of view of grounded theory research, but grounded in the experience of the writers, the experience of the young people that we wrote about, the experience of practitioners that we've talked to, and so on. So without that sort of explicit, it's not quite, but almost true theory building, right? That was for me, that was kind of the goal of what we were doing here. So in classic kind of academic style, you have theorists, you have researchers who test theory. So for me then, that's the next step, not necessarily one that I would take, but my hope would be that someone will look at this and go, like maybe you, Wolfgang, okay, let's check this out, right? Let's go find out whether or not this works, and we'll design a study of some kind and take theory and do some systematic testing of theory. So that's one answer to your question. I think the other answer to your question is that theory works if you believe that it works and if it's working for you as a practitioner. So people need to take the concepts into the field and test them out, see if they work for them, talk about them in their practice and lay them over the work that they're doing and see what happens, and validate them for themselves.
I think that both those answers are wonderful. I agree. We do need a theory in this field that comes from the field and belongs to the field. And I hope this book does motivate people to test these theories, because I think that there's a lot in them that seem sensible to me. Upon reading, they make sense, and I think that they really capture a lot of what is happening in the field. And I hope people do take you up and start testing those and see if it works. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Carol Stewart,
for thank you.
Joining us. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
I don't think so. Thank you for asking, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Excellent.
So thank you very much.
So did I. I think it's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.